session number 10687, rule 7.
This little airplane really had its origins in an experimental jet-propelled aircraft, which was produced right towards the end of the war when the Germans were producing the ME-262, and there was a bit of a flap about that. And so the quickest way of producing a little jet aircraft was to use a spiteful wing, put it on a new fuselage, which would be a very simple little fuselage with a hole at the front and a hole at the back and a place for the pilot to sit, and which could be produced very, very quickly. And that became known as the E-1044 experimental aircraft. And because the spiteful wing was already in production and we had to take it without alteration, this little jet aircraft had to have a tailwheel layout, because otherwise the spiteful wing would have had to have been completely changed for the undercarriage. So we screwed the spiteful wing onto this new fuselage, which became the E-1044, and it was quite a good little airplane. And then the war stopped, of course, so all the sort of steam went out of this experimental job. But then the Navy decided that they would be interested in it, partly because it had a tailwheel layout and not a nose wheel, and the Navy were uncertain about how nose wheels were going to work on an aircraft carrier. So they ordered 200 of these little things, which then became the Attacker. And it went into service in, fairly shortly after the war. And it was the first production jet aircraft the Navy ever had. And so it was roughly equivalent to the Sea Hawk, which came in later.
Going back to the pre-war period, I think that in 1935 you visited Nazi Germany. Can you tell me what you saw then?
Oh, well, that was just really a sort of fun thing. I was serving at Duxford at the time, so I was still in the Air Force, and a friend of mine called Bob Preller, we decided that we would hire a couple of little light aircraft from Heston. We hired one puss moth, one leopard moth, and another thing called an Avro, a little airplane. And we set off we got some passengers to share the expenses, and we set off with this little armada and for a trip around Europe. And we went round, this was in 1935, and we went round Germany and Holland and Denmark and so on. And but it was during the trip to Germany we were very much interested in, of course, because by that time one knew that I think one was pretty sure that eventually the war might take place. So we were all interested in what we could see in Germany. We went mostly to we went to Munich, and we went to Vienna, and we went to Dresden and Berlin, and then we went on to Copenhagen and back to Amsterdam and home. was only about just over a week, and we had a lot of fun, and we saw a lot of interesting things in Germany. But
such as?
Well, in those days there was very thriving club flying going on, and there were, I would say that most of the flying clubs were rather, had a distinctly sort of paramilitary sort of atmosphere about them, and we never saw anything very secret or anything of that sort, but we weren't allowed to go to any Luftwaffe airfield or anything of that sort. So we went to private aerodromes.
So did you feel that they were much of a threat?
Well, yes, one felt all the time that you know, Germany was sort of very much in a sort of resurgence. I mean, the whole place was a hive of activity, and it was fairly obvious that. And I remember I rather had the impression that we were rather being left behind in our country and not getting on with it. But that was, of course, I suppose, a fairly natural feeling. But,
do you remember Charles Lindbergh visiting Supermarine?
Oh, yes, yes, he did. He came to us one of his visits, and that must have been in about 1937 or 38, I think. And it was before the Spitfire was really... the Spitfire production had got going properly, but and he had just been on a visit to Germany, where of course the Germans had pushed the boat out for him in a big way, and he'd obviously been much impressed with what he'd seen of the German aircraft industry, and he flew himself into Eastleigh one day, and I had the job of meeting him and showing him our erecting shop in the hangar at Eastleigh, which was then full of a small number of Spitfires being in the process of final assembly. And it was a fairly tatty old shop, you know. It was an old World War hangar with these big wooden truss roofs, you know, sort of things you've got at Duxford. And I remember when I took old Lindbergh in there. There were quite a few Spitfires there in the course of final assembly, and I forget whether we were flying them then or not. But anyway, I remember old Lindbergh looking around this place, and he looked up at the roof, and you know, I could tell exactly what was going on inside his mind. He'd been around these sort of very sort of fine sort of chromium plated modern factories in the German industry, and he was obviously thinking to himself, well, you know, these bloody Brits are just you know, they're just playing with the idea. What he didn't know was, of course, that we had a much superior airplane in the Spitfire to what the 109s were, and the German aircraft were. And I must say, he was a very nice chap, Lindbergh. I've got nothing against him at all, but it annoyed me, and I very nearly said to him, I could tell him exactly what he was thinking, you know, and I bloody nearly said to him, well, you know, you can think what you bloody well like, but you wait. And but however, he went off in the end in his aeroplane, and I was very glad of the opportunity to meet him. He was a wonderful chap, but of course he was completely wrong. But he was very much he was not the only American who was called it wrong. I mean, look at old that chap Kennedy, you know, who was the ambassador over here. I mean, he was he'd misjudged the whole situation very badly.
During your days at Supermarines, before the war and during the war, was there tight security about not letting any secrets out?
Oh, well, of course, I mean, there was, yes, I mean, one wasn't allowed to discuss any sort of performance figures of the thing, and I think this... I would imagine the security wasn't as tight as it should have been, but I mean, it was certainly, as far as any of us in Supermarines were concerned, we were well aware of the need for security. We didn't want to, both from a national point of view and, of course, from a commercial point of view as well. So, it was, but things were much more free and easy in those days than they are now, of course.